whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to the second season of Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that I am allowed to ask follow-up questions. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
My name is Jonathan Wolfe, Joe Wolfe. I am currently the Alfred Landecker Professor of Values and Public Policy at the Blavatnik School of Government in Oxford. Before that, for many, many years, I was in the philosophy department at UCL, University College London. I'm a political philosopher. I now work mostly on areas where political philosophy and public policy might have something to do with each other.
Well, I want to ask you about a book you wrote that I really love and that may or may not connect with work you're doing now, which is Why Read Marx Today? How does Marx fit together with the other kinds of work you've done in political philosophy?
Well, that book came about through a strange connection of events. At that time, I was the head of the department of UCL philosophy, and we were going through something called subject review, which is roughly when the government inspectors come in to make sure that we are teaching philosophy properly. It was the first time this had ever been done. And as head of department, I was spending all day long getting paperwork together, you know, making up minutes of meetings that took place in corridors and official minutes had never been taken and so on. So all day long, I was doing this terrible paperwork. And someone from Oxford University Press came to see me and asked me if I was interested in writing a short book. And I thought, well, I've got no time to do that. And she gave me a list of all the things. And one of them was, you know, what is the relevance of Marx today? And they only wanted 25,000 words. I had maybe 5,000, 8,000 already written in an article. I thought, I know what, to relieve the dullness of my day, I'll write this book. And so I did. I wrote the book on the London Underground, on the way to work and the way back again, 30 minutes in the morning and 30 minutes in the evening in a little notebook. And what I did really was just write out the lectures I'd been giving for a number of years. So I drafted it from start to finish without looking at any references, typed it up, and then I went back to check the references. And of course, I found some things were wrong and so on. I found some new things. But it was really my way of telling the system I could still do some work even in the midst of all this bureaucracy.
That's great. So Marx helped you deal with alienation at work in a very direct way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was very funny. My son was young at this time and I was, you know, paid in advance for the book. And whenever he wanted my attention, I told him, look, I've just got to write down another 100 words and that'll be, you know, £20 or whatever. and he respected that. So he gave me time to, you know, 15 minutes to write another 100 words before we played together.
So I'm going to ask you the first official question, which is an Iris Murdoch-inspired question. She begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but she also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. So does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
So this is something I've had to think about, because I regard myself, others may not agree, but I regard myself as very even-tempered. I rarely get angry. I rarely get ecstatically happy either. So, you know, how does my temperament influence me? So one thing is I have this type of anxiety quite often that I'm missing out on something or failing to appreciate it. So if someone's talking about a philosopher I haven't read, I will maybe try to get hold of their book. I won't read it. You never have time to read it. But I feel that, you know, there's something I'm missing out on. I've got to have this in my collection, and one day I'll look at it. Also, maybe it's not a matter of temperament, but of character. When I was a teenager, I read Rousseau's Confessions, and there was something there that really struck me. He said that he had terrible trouble concentrating on anything for more than about 30 minutes. But luckily, if he changed subject to something else, he could work on that for 30 minutes and then something else for 30 minutes. He said that way he could work all day, but he would be jumping from topic to topic. And okay, I'm not as extreme as that, but I always need to be working on more than one thing. And if I work for an hour or two on one topic, you know, that's quite a long time at a stretch for me. So that's sort of moving from topic to topic, doing many different things, rather than having one solid project that I'm devoting all my attention to. I don't know if that's a matter of temperament, but that is something about how I work.
So I could see how this would show up in your work in leading you to write about a variety of different topics rather than one main thing, to be a fox rather than a hedgehog. Do you think it also shows up in your views in any way, the kinds of positions you take?
Well, the older I've got, I think I've become less and less interested in taking positions and having arguments for those positions, and just much more interested in seeing how things fit together and how different people's views can be compared and contrasted. I mean, obviously, I do have philosophical positions in some areas, but for me, I feel I'm still learning. I'm not settled. You know, people told me I said something in a paper 10 years ago. I think, did I really say that? I mean, did I even believe it then? I'm not sure. And so I'm still floating around trying to work out what I think about a lot of different things. And now a much more, not a huge picture, but a medium-sized picture philosopher, less interested in fine details and just trying to work out how arguments work, where the pressure is, what are the challenges.
It's funny, I resonate with a lot of that. I find my sense of the importance of working through the details has really changed. And now I have a kind of complicated relation to it in that I think philosophy is hard enough that the chances of being right at the level of fine detail are incredibly low. So I shouldn't really worry too much about the fine details. If I'm going to be right about anything, it will be, as you say, sort of medium picture level. On the other hand, it seems sort of crucial often to figuring out what to think at the medium picture level to force yourself to work through all the fine details. So there's this sort of instrumental attitude to working through that where I think, yeah, this is almost certainly wrong, but it'd be good to know that there is a way to work out the view in detail with the kind of rigor that philosophers sometimes ask for. I mean, do you find yourself impatient with the demand to spell out all the details?
So increasingly, I find myself impatient with the details when I'm asked to do it. It's quite interesting, you know, when I'm supervising a graduate student, of course, it's very important for people to be able to do that and to learn those skills. I sometimes think of it like in the army, where people are trained on an obstacle course. Now, they're never actually going to have to go through an obstacle course, but doing that gives them some skills that they may find very useful in another context. I think the arguments are like that. So I think it's important that my students have good arguments. I come up with counterexamples. I try to help them improve their arguments. But I am much more interested in, you know, what is the question you're asking? How are you going to formulate that question? What are the possible answers people can have? You know, what is your answer? Why have you preferred that answer to other answers? And that's medium level. Often it does require going into the details, but that's not what interests me anymore. And you know, in political philosophy, I've written about this at one point. I think, you know, people go into political philosophy because of their sense of justice. So they see something wrong with the world, but they do their undergraduate work and they do their graduate work. And what's rewarded there is not anything to do with social activism or justice in the real world. You know, what's rewarded is being able to see a three-way distinction when other people have only seen a two-way distinction, or being able to show something follows or doesn't follow. So our motivation for going into the subject is not what is rewarded that gets us our career. I think it takes some of us quite a long time to get back to the reasons why we went into this in the first place, because we get a bit intoxicated with our own skills that we've demonstrated along the way.
Well, let me ask you a second question about temperament in philosophy or character in philosophy. Is there a trait you wish you had more of as a philosopher?
Well, in a way, it's the polar opposite of what I've been saying. Because when I was younger, I suppose, and thought about what an academic life would be like, or what it is like to be a philosopher, I had this idea of, you know, philosophers going up to their study after dinner, you know, sitting at a leather-topped desk surrounded with books, you know, making careful notes, maybe with index systems and getting really deeply into something and, you know, not noticing the time going, getting absolutely sucked into a project that they did day after day after day, or maybe working for months in an archive and producing incredibly thoughtful, considered, yeah, meticulously researched work. And I think I would prefer to be that type of philosopher, but I'm not. So I can't work in the evening. You know, if I try to work in the evening, I don't work very well, and I pay back double the next day. So if I stay up an extra hour I can't write at all the next morning, and so on. So yeah, I have probably exactly the opposite traits to the ones that I really admire in people in philosophy. But you know, that's life. You can't have everything.
Is there a philosopher who you think of as the model of what you aren't, but used to admire or admire?
Well, I don't know, because I don't know how other people work. I mean, it may be that we all have this image of people in their at their leather top desk in their big armchair, sort of inhaling the work and chewing it over and providing a sort of finely tilled version. But maybe no one does that. I don't know. Of course, I've read biographies, but how accurate are they? So I haven't seen other philosophers at work, really. So I don't know. It's just a matter of my imagination.
It's a strange thing. It's also not very easy to convey in a biography, partly because intellectuals and academics and writers, their lives are fairly dull, because an immense amount of it is just sitting around writing, thinking. It's not the parts of their lives that the biography is likely to focus on, because the parts that are interesting are the bits where they're not just sitting at the desk, but interacting with other people or having affairs or quitting their jobs, that kind of thing.
And that's why so few philosophers' lives are really worth writing and reading about, I suppose. Although I have increasingly gotten into the habit of reading biographies of philosophers. I think in the last 10 or 20 years, we've seen developments of this genre in a very exciting way. We've had very skillful writers who've made probably what were very dull lives rather interesting.
Do you have an example in mind? Is there a biography you've read recently that you would recommend?
So I've been reading quite a few biographies or collected biographies about the Vienna Circle.
Yeah.
So Dave Edmonds' recent book, The Death of Professor Schlick, I think it's called, Exact Thinking in Demented Times, The Time of the Magicians. These are fabulous books. Others as well, and even very short biographical works or semi-biographical works. So there's a new volume edited by Rebecca Buxton and Lisa Whiting called The Philosopher Queens, which is a combination of short biography and short introduction to the work of female philosophers, many of whom are barely known. And you know, it's really quite moving to read about the struggles they had even to have any chance of getting their ideas out and known.
Well, those are all, yeah, excellent recommendations. So having talked about some books about philosophy that you recommend, here's question three. What's the most important work of philosophy you've never read?
So I doubt I'm alone in this. I mean, there are so many I haven't read that I feel I should have done, but the one that really sticks out for me is The Critique of Pure Reason. I mean, I know the plot lines. I've been to lectures. I went to lectures by Roger Scruton. I've read a number of secondary texts and other works by Kant that are related, but it's never been the time to sit down with The Critique and look at it from start to finish. I partly blame my education for this, of course, and this is what we always have to do. So when I studied philosophy as an undergraduate, we had a course called Modern Philosophy from Bacon to Reid, which was curious because neither Bacon or Reid seemed to be on the syllabus.
Uh-huh.
And it was, in fact, Locke, Berkeley, Hume, Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz, and Kant. And it was taught by a wonderful teacher, Arnold Zuboff, who was completely taken by Descartes to a point where he almost presented himself as Descartes. So Descartes took up so much time, we barely got to Spinoza and Leibniz, and there was a half an hour on Kant at the end of it. And Kant was never a required text for me. And as I've said, at the time when I was studying in the UK, you specialize at graduate school very early on. I just really reread texts I'd read as undergraduates, like working on political philosophy and ethics and Marxism. So I never had that broadening that you get in a US graduate school. I did go to the US just for 1 year as a graduate student. I'm sure if I'd stayed longer, I would have been forced to read The Critique of Pure Reason at some point. That never happened to me. I'm probably too old now to start.
So you don't have the fantasy of, you know, when you retire, sitting back, but, well, not with the leather-covered desk, but in the leather armchair by the fire and reading The Critique of Pure Reason?
Of course I have the fantasy, but I know it's the fantasy. I think it's extremely unlikely that it will happen.
Well, so maybe I'll pivot from a book you haven't read to the more potentially optimistic thought of whether there's progress in philosophy and what form you think that progress takes.
Well, if this was an exam question, it would be, do you think there is progress in philosophy? If so, what form do you think it takes? Because I think the progress in philosophy is rather small, and it's sort of overlaid on something that may not be considered progress in the normal sense. Because I think that we recycle a tremendous amount in philosophy, and we do this without realizing what we're doing. So very often, you know, you think you've come up with a new idea, you find it in the journals, or you think there's a new debate, you find people were talking about that 100 years ago. And I got very excited thinking about social equality, or some people call it relational equality, as if it had been invented 20 years ago, only to find it in the 1920s, only to find it in the 1800s, only to find it probably in the 1500s. I can't say that, but I'm sure it's there and in the ancient world. And one way in which this was brought home to me very, very clearly is in a paper by the philosopher Margaret MacDonald from 1941, a paper called The Language of Political Theory. And she's talking in the context of theories of political obligation, which is an area I've worked on. And, you know, we have a number of different theories. Some theories are fashionable, some theories are unfashionable. We have this sort of competition between theories. Margaret MacDonald, and this is really to paraphrase her, says that in order to work, really, philosophers have to have this illusion that they're doing something brand new, something that people haven't done before. But very often what we're doing is pointing to something that is relatively neglected at the time. So that there could be a type of consensus view, and we shake it up by, you know, someone coming in and saying something completely different, as if it's brand new. But very often that was already there, and maybe it was there in the sort of common culture, but philosophers had forgotten about it or neglected it. So, you know, in my area, political philosophy, libertarianism with Robert Nozick was presented as this incredibly sharp challenge to the theory of equality of John Rawls and others. And what did it do? Well, you know, it picked up values of property rights and maybe responsibility that views on the left hadn't given much weight to in the past. And you know, you could think, some people might think, well, you know, Nozick has invented these ideas, or he's discovered a new way of putting things. But all he did really was encapsulate things that people would be talking about in ordinary arguments and putting them in a very sharp, very philosophical form. So I think a lot of philosophy is like that. And it goes with a picture I have, which I think about in relation to our value concepts, but it could apply elsewhere. So if you think about our values, you know, we have many values: liberty, equality, respect, deserts, and so on. And you know, philosophers try to work out, you know, which one is prior or how to fit them together. And I think of it as like a jigsaw puzzle, but with too many pieces. And so if you're trying to put any view together, there are things you're going to be leaving out. And what happens in the next generation is that someone says, look, you've left this out. Or they don't do that. They say, this bit's missing, and we have to put this in. But in order to put that in, something else has to come out again. And we go on and on. So there's progress in a sense of moving from one cycle to another, and probably it can be a little bit better each time, a little bit sharper, some innovations. But the main innovation, I think, is just rediscovering or reinventing things that have been around before.
I mean, that could be a very pessimistic view about the value of philosophy, but you didn't say it in a pessimistic way. You made it sound as though the fact that there's a kind of jigsaw that's not going to be completed is okay, because the process of sort of putting it together and each time neglecting or giving short shrift to one piece rather than the others is nevertheless productive in some way. I mean, can you say something about the value of the process conceived in the way you just described it?
So I think you're right. This could be very pessimistic. And sometimes I do feel pessimistic. So if I think I've come up with something and then, you know, read a quote from 50 years before that says more or less the same thing, which, you know, happens to me all the time, I have mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, I think how wonderful someone had that thought and they've said it better than me. But I also think, you know, it's a bit disappointing not to have come up with something new. So that's the pessimistic time. But I think of philosophy as a living subject. I don't think of it as something that's just in other people's books. I think it has to be in our heads. And it has to be in our students' heads. And, you know, the only way in which it will be is if we continue to have the same arguments and we continue to have the same variations on those arguments. Now, you could say the game, you know, about the game of football, you know, every move has ever been made. And people said this about rock music, every chord sequence has already been used. But we don't just say, well, we stop. These are living things, living, breathing traditions. We have to continually be remaking them. We think we're making them, and maybe we are making a little bit, but we're, if we didn't remake them, they would be dead and worthless. So I think the value is in the process. I suppose what I think in philosophy is it's quite rare that the value is in the results, but the value is in the activity, and it's part of a broader culture.
I think I'm going to break my unofficial rule of not deliberately asking very, very hard philosophical questions by asking you one. And then if you want to refuse to answer it, that's fine. Or we can cut this later. But I'm so curious about the way in which in the process, one has to sort of think of oneself as trying to come up with the final truth. The picture of people going through this process, the value of it doesn't involve the result, but nevertheless, they're sort of thinking of themselves as hoping to reach that final truth that will, what is it that Wittgenstein says, with an explosion, destroy all the other books in the world. Like the sort of final statement of the theory of justice or whatever it might be. I mean, is there a kind of doublethink that has to be involved in doing philosophy as you understand it?
So this is a really important question. And I was very taken by Mill's memoir of Bentham. Yeah, Mill, of course, began as a follower of Bentham and then had his breakdown and realized that Bentham was very one-sided and was then influenced by Wordsworth and the Romantic movement to try to have type of compromise between something more deep-souled alongside the efficiency of utilitarianism. And Mill calls Bentham a one-eyed man. And he says that philosophy depends on the existence of one-eyed men because they see deeper and with a more penetrating vision than the rest of us. What I mean by this is that there are people, you know, philosophy would not exist if everyone believed what I did about the nature of philosophy. Mm-hmm. I think philosophy needs some people who think they are on the verge of getting to the single truth. And as you say, it's going to destroy everything else. We do have some people like that. Maybe we all start like that. Maybe I started like that. Maybe as a graduate student, you have to think, maybe I'm going to be the one that blows all of this out of the water. But there comes a point when you think, well, I don't have the talent to do that, but I can see other people are doing it. And then you might think, well, I can see other people are thinking they're doing that, and I'm really grateful to them because they're giving us some very interesting material for the rest of us to think about. So I'm more of a witness to people who have that view. I'm glad they exist. I feel very sheepish about talking about these things, actually. Sometimes I think I ought to keep my views quiet about this because, you know, if everyone believed me, maybe the subject would grind to a halt. So I'm parasitic on people who don't believe me to keep the subject going.
That's really a fascinating structure to find in philosophy as a collective activity, and certainly possible that it depends for its existence on different people having different aims, some of which are misguided or quixotic, but nevertheless essential. I'm going to ask you one last question. This is the second Iris Murdoch question, beginning with a quote. It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher, she wrote. What is he afraid of? So what are you afraid of?
You think I'm going to tell you
the
answer to that question? So, yeah, it's not a natural question for me. So what am I afraid of? Well, I do joke a little bit about this. I'm not a natural note taker. I don't write in books. If I write notes, I can never find them. I, of course, have some very short lecture notes, but they're just headings. And I'm someone who, when I give a public talk or a lecture or even something like this, I talk and then an anecdote comes to mind, or a story comes to mind, or an example comes to mind. And I constantly rely on myself to generate sort of the right passage from the right book at the right time, or the right bit of soap opera I saw 25 years ago to illustrate something. So I'm very reliant on my memory, and I can tell it's not as sharp as it once was. So the thing I'm really afraid of is the bump on the head that makes that all go away, because it's not written down or filed anywhere. But really, what drives me is not what I'm afraid of, but what I'm embarrassed by, or rather what I'm collectively embarrassed by on behalf of philosophy. So I find myself sometimes being something of an apologist to my fellow philosophers and trying to explain why our work is relevant. So, you know, here's an anecdote, yet another anecdote that could illustrate this. Many years ago, it seems many years ago now, when after a lot of years of what we refer to as Tory misrule, the Labour government was finally elected, the Blair government was finally elected. And Gordon Brown was something of an intellectual, still is something of an intellectual. He had read John Rawls, he was interested in political philosophy, and he organised a seminar at 11 Downing Street. It was an academic seminar, but with policymakers and journalists. And I was very lucky. I was much younger then, of course, but I knew someone who had helped organize it. And I was invited to come along and sit at the back. And a very famous political philosopher was invited to give a talk on their work. And I thought this was such an exciting time, because the Labour government had just been elected. It was hungry for ideas, and it was prepared to consult with the academic community. And so this particular philosopher went along. I knew they had views on the left. I was very interested to see how they would engage with the top politicians of the day. And what they did was give the most abstract talk you can imagine, that was the sort of thing they would have done in an ordinary philosophy seminar, which in a way was fine, because, you know, a lot of these people had studied philosophy at university. They were quite keen to get back into that. But I thought, what a missed opportunity. Here we are. And I felt embarrassed for philosophy that we didn't seize that opportunity to do something to try to directly influence ideas, rather than just give sort of very formal models. And so a lot of my work since then has been thinking about, you know, believing in the value of what we do. I always believe in the value of what we do as philosophers, but trying to work out of embarrassment how to convince others of it. And I think that has led me in the direction that my work has gone.
Well, maybe there's progress in philosophy there, and that I think, or maybe this is cyclical too, but there's a wider movement in philosophy now, I feel, towards communicating philosophy in a greater variety of ways and with more diverse audiences, in a way that makes me hopeful that the kind of talk you're describing would be less likely to happen now than it was when it happened and you were there. I hope that's true.
So I think that is true, but at the same time, you know, it's very easy to forget what happened not one generation ago, maybe, but two generations ago. So, you know, when I was at school, there was a television program called Men of Ideas, actually on TV, interviewing philosophers. And I saw people like Charles Taylor on television, a bit later Martha Nussbaum on television. So, you know, that idea of communicating philosophy, it has been there a long time. And at certain times, there have been figures in this country like A.J. Eyre or Bernard Williams, who've often been on the television or radio, and their views have been respected. That seems to have disappeared to some degree. I mean, one interesting thing, of course, in the current pandemic is that a lot of academics are being drawn into the media now, because, you know, particularly in the medical side, the people who actually know things that other people need to know about. But it's also happening in the ethics side as well. So anyone who's ever worked in bioethics or public health ethics is finding that people want to know what they think. And this can be about writing for newspapers, many podcasts. So we're seeing something a bit more vibrant just at the moment. I don't know how long it will last. I hope the pandemic does not last for long, so we lose that particular opportunity. But there's a bit of momentum going on there.
Well, let's end with that momentum. And I'll say thank you so much for appearing on the podcast.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. And I've greatly enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you.
Jonathan Wolfe is the Alfred Landecker Professor of Values and Public Policy at the University of Oxford. He's the author of several books, including The Human Right to Health and Ethics and Public Policy, A Philosophical Inquiry. Thanks for listening to 5 Questions.